It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
I've been reading, as you have, about the terrible earthquake that has killed so many and from which more will die, reading about the continued troubles and perhaps now escalating troubles in the Middle East following the recent election. And I was reminded of an old preacher's line when John Donne said that no man is an island, and was reminded of the Roman Stoic Seneca in one of my favorite lines in history when he wrote that we are all limbs on the body of humanity. We feel a shiver of pain from some of those other parts in the body of humanity at these stories and at stories which strike closer to home. And part of becoming fully human is the ability to feel that shiver of pain without being paralyzed by it. Within our church community, we remember in prayer Audrey Baker, who is in Michigan with her dying father. Sylvia Voles, a neighbor of many in this church, who passed away suddenly on Wednesday. She leaves behind her husband and two young children. Her burial will be tomorrow morning in her hometown of Laredo, Texas. Doris and Henry Hugg announced the birth of their second granddaughter and fourth grandchild, Liana, who was born in Berkeley, California on January 19th. And we remember in prayer Austin Meyer, the 15-year-old grandson of Herman and Helen Nelson. He was taken to Breckenridge Hospital yesterday. He has an unexplained, so far, bleeding in his brain. He is in critical condition in pediatric intensive care. And we remember in prayer those other names which we now speak aloud or hold in our silence together. As many of you have read in the latest church newsletter, the last two, your governing board and I have been very busy during the last month on two very exciting projects in addition to all the other things that we're usually busy with. The first of those was the remarkable offer of 142 acres of land in the hill country, complete with four buildings, a new barn, and an outdoor pool, which I'll confess some call a stagnant stock tank. It's a nice pool. It just has a green bottom. Some of you have visited the land. I hope others will make the trip out to see it before you vote on whether to accept this gift in the congregational meeting 2 weeks from today. It's free. There are some legal and financial details, though, that we are still investigating, and there are some good, sober questions about it that we want to resolve, but it's an amazing gift filled with exciting possibilities. For me, though, the other project was even more exciting. Your board and I developed an ambitious model for serving the church that we have modestly called the Austin Model. This model will evolve and change over time, like a living thing would do. Its essence is really very simple, and I think it's very commonsensical. We know that organizations, including churches, exist to make a difference in the world, not just to sit there and keep dust from hitting that part of land. We know they're supposed to be doing something, and that it matters what they're doing. And we think you ought to be able to measure what it is you're doing and assess whether that's what you still want to be doing. It's like sailing a boat rather than minding the store. And sailing a boat is one of the metaphors that we're using for thinking how to operate a church. It's like standing on the bridge to see where you're actually going and how you're getting there and what course corrections you need to make, instead of being in the engine room measuring the oil levels. So we're not just trying to stay afloat. We need to ask where we're going and are we making any progress. We want to begin consciously planning the actions of myself and the other staff to make a positive difference in the lives of our members, our children, and the community, and to be able to articulate what we think those differences are. We get no credit for trying. We get credit for accomplishing. This may all sound very obvious, and you might expect that, of course, all churches and all organizations would think this way. But they don't. And to be honest, it is an intimidating model to work under. Even though I've worked very hard to try to help get it articulated as something we could do, it is very intimidating. It was much easier the old way, because there were so many more places to hide. We would take your money and your energy and your trust, and we would just keep the ship afloat. My job is sort of do sermons and sort of do counseling, and the RE director's job is kind of get classes staffed. And if we do that, we've done our job, and that's about it. And we never look where it goes, what it's measuring, what it's doing. What we're trying to do in this model is take you and your money and your trust a lot more seriously. And we're also saying, my gosh, we've got about $500,000 a year here that we're taking from the community. If the money weren't given here, it could be given somewhere else in the community. How do we account for that? How do we look the community in the face and say, here's what we're doing that's worth that kind of money and that's worth the time and talent and energy of over 500 adults? I think we need to be able to answer that question to ourselves and to the community. I think you need to be able to answer it to your Baptist and Catholic friends who wonder what in hell you're doing here. But this changes everything. This changes my focus in planning sermons. I didn't expect this, but it's happening. I wonder what I should do to be more intentional and effective in addressing issues and what the issues should be that might indeed make a positive difference in your life, the lives of your children, and our community. How do we choose the things in life that might make a positive difference? How do we tell them from the others? If we're motivated to make our interactions with other people creative rather than destructive, how do we do that? Or in terms of this morning's puppet show, how do we choose those things we need to make a home? Or how do we choose those feathered things that can help our spirit take flight? It was Emily Dickinson who said that hope is the thing with feathers. I have always loved that definition. Hope is the thing with feathers, the thing that lifts us up. How do we choose that thing? We don't always do it. There's plenty to gripe about, if we'd rather not, you know. Our lives aren't as perfect as we fantasize they should be. Not everybody loves us. Not everybody even understands us. Our jobs are like most jobs, filled with ups and downs, but they're not ideal. And as of this week, there are over 4,000 fewer of those jobs in Austin, a number that may soon increase. That's something like 3-4% of the population of the greater Austin metro area. That's a lot. Besides our jobs, our relationships are seldom perfect. And our kids will almost all grow up to be regular old adults rather than the envy of the civilized world. They will probably make about as many dumb mistakes as we did, and so will their kids and their kids' kids. It's easy to just sit it out and gripe and say, nuts, I don't like this place or this place or this place or any place. And we do it too often and we do it too easily, don't we? It's as though we come to believe that the world owes us something. As though we were born with a long list of entitlements that we check off as we go through life and gripe when we don't get them on time. I don't think we are. I think there's only one gift offered to us, and that's the gift of life itself. And I would suggest that we are paid in full the day we're born. After that, it's up to us to learn how to negotiate for the other things we wish we had and how to create the conditions for which we yearn. I don't think the world owes us love. It doesn't even owe us justice. Those are conditions we have to create if we really want them, and we have to be willing to pay the price to get them. We were given life and the chance to make something of it or to just sit and be disappointed. It matters what we believe, and it matters what we choose. And given the choice, I think we have to work to discover who we are and make a home for ourselves in life, and need to choose the things of hope. And I think we must wish the same for others and try to make our interactions with them positive rather than negative. If our beliefs can't help us do that, we probably have the wrong beliefs. If they can help us do that, they're probably working fairly well for us. That's a pretty pragmatic approach to religion, but I think it's a right one. But the only real miracle is the gift of life. It wasn't supposed to be perfect. It was only supposed to present itself and let us see what we would do with it. If we sit back like couch potatoes waiting for life to please us, it'll be a long wait. I don't think that bus is coming. All this is true in life. And it's true in the microcosms of life, which means it's also true in churches, including this one. Several years ago, though it could have been 40 years ago, it's been true at least that long. Several years ago, I was talking about things like this with two colleagues in Michigan, and we discovered that the same visitor had been to each of our churches about three times and then went away. So she had visited a Unitarian church, an American Baptist church, and a Liberal Disciples of Christ church. That's covering pretty good territory. And then she went away. They were all good churches with good people and adequate ministers. In each one, the visitor could have found ways to ask her questions, to meet challenging and comforting friends, to struggle with spiritual issues on several levels. None of the churches was any more perfect than the visitor was, but they were all good enough. Maybe she finally found a church someplace where she decided to take root, make friends, and become a participant rather than an onlooker. But if so, she was the exception. Most don't. Now, it's easy to read this as a failure of the church to integrate visitors, and churches can be guilt-induced into this almost immediately. We could do more to integrate visitors into the body of the church, and we should, and every church I've ever heard of has this discussion going on all the time and has for decades. But it isn't only a failure of the churches. It's also the habit of people to see themselves too often as shoppers who keep moving until something finds a way of keeping them there.
as though they were passive and the world's job is to be active. If you're a visitor here or have been coming for a few months, here's something to think about. Less than half of you will still be here a year from now. In this or any other church, most who come never join, never make a commitment, never become a part of the church. Liberal churches, conservative churches, big churches, little churches, it's the same. Most visitors don't last a year. I think people visit churches sort of thinking, well, all right, I'll just sit here quietly and see if they all swarm around me to make me feel welcome. The truth is, it isn't likely to happen very often. So while I want to welcome all visitors, and I think swarms are kind of neat, I want to challenge you. Don't be passive here. Don't expect these good people to try harder to keep you than you try to stay. We're not any better at it than you are. And creating a relationship like creating a tango takes two. And the way you stay, here or anywhere, in church or in life, is to seek for and choose those things, those relationships, that you can build on and grow from, that offer you home and offer you hope. Seek the things you need to make a home for yourself here, and seek the hopeful things, the bits that nourish you. Now, this isn't something that I've always known. I think it's very wise, but it isn't a wisdom I was born with. It's something I learned in a memorable moment. While I can't give you the experience, I can tell you the story. It was about 20 years ago, in a preaching class in graduate school. David, our professor, was a very gifted preacher who was deeply serious about the ministry and about professionalism and responsibility and those things. Our seminar met on Monday, and in those minutes before a class began, several of the students on this Monday were whining about the church they all attended, complaining that the preacher was horrible, the service was amateurish, and they didn't get a single thing out of it. That rang just about every bell David had, and he glared at these future ministers and said, "How hard did you try? If you didn't get anything out of it, how hard did you try?" That's the first time I really understood that attending a worship service, like attending to life, is meant to be an activity, not a passivity. It changed a lot for me. The church I attended during graduate school also had a horrible preacher. I loved him, but I can't remember a single thing he ever preached on. And I could fall into whining, and did fall into whining, about not getting anything out of the worship services as quickly as the next person could. It's so easy to do. But after that day in class, that question, "How hard did you try?" stayed with me like one of those ghosts that you can hardly pay enough money to be haunted by. And while I seldom heard a sermon worth remembering in the next 5 years, I was always glad I had attended church, because each week, I went to work. I saw it as a personal challenge to find something moving, something memorable in the service, and if I didn't find it, I took it as my failure, not theirs. They weren't necessarily big things. We had a liturgical dance choir. Every time they performed, it was them. Sometimes it was the organist. Sometimes it was the sound or feel of a particular hymn. Sometimes it was just sitting there as the candles were extinguished at the end of the service, watching the wispy smoke go up into the dark ceiling of the big old stone church, and thinking of the smoke as a spirit set free, and keeping that image alive in me for the next week, and looking at life through that image as a lens. But every Sunday I went to church to try to find something, and it made all the difference. So if you're a visitor or have been coming here less than a year, I want to offer you this challenge. Don't sit passively with us. Come try. Or if this doesn't suit you, find another church that does and try there. And if you're here next February, come see me. Tell me you're still here. And tell me what you did to find a home here and to find hope. If you want to feel chosen, you have to choose. And if you want to feel that you're in a friendly community, you have to make friends. So I challenge you to come see me next year and tell me how you did it. Now, some of you are sitting here and thinking, yeah, right. It's a lot easier said than done. Talk's cheap. He's the guy in the costume. He can say that. I know that we sit passively. We hesitate to reach out. We hesitate to meet new people, partly because the truth is most of us really aren't very good at it, and we don't know what to do. But also because it's very risky. You could fail. You could be rebuffed. You could be embarrassed. And if you try it very many times, I will guarantee that you will be. It's so easy to stand back, mind the shop, wait and see. Maybe the world will take the active part. But I think it's like sailing a boat again. So I want to go back to my boat sailing metaphor. I think a lot of life is like sailing a boat. On the shore, as long as you keep it on the shore, dry and pretty, the boat looks great. And you can have all the fantasies you like about how cool it would be to be sailing. But once you actually put the boat in the water, it gets a lot messier. The wind comes up, the balance shifts, you have to learn what you're doing, and not all the lessons keep you dry. I like the sailing metaphor, even though my own experience with sailboats has not been impressive. I was about 16 the first time I went sailing. My friend Tom took me out in his family's small sailboat. He steered. I sat on one side, feeling the breeze and thinking how cool this was, this sailing business. Within a few minutes, Tom uttered the strangest sentence I had ever heard in my life. "Prepare to come about," he said. I thought, that's cool. Now I really know I'm a sailor because we're talking sailing talk. This is so cool. And then, with absolutely no warning, I learned what that forward bit of sailing talk meant. For the landlubbers here, those words are a kind of evil sailing shorthand, and they mean in about 3 seconds the sail is going to swing across the boat, hit you in the chest, knock you overboard, and tip the boat over. Tom explained that to me while we were swimming around in the middle of the lake. And I decided right there, bobbing up and down like fish bait, that I didn't like sailing very much. I like the idea of sailing and the fantasies about it, as long as no boat containing me ever touched the water. I have sailed since then, just not in little boats. So I understand the fear of failure firsthand. And I understand the fact that wishing something were so doesn't accomplish a thing, although it's nowhere near as intimidating as actually trying to make it so. I suspect that's why in so many areas of life we're controlled by our fears rather than our hopes. It's hard to find the thing with feathers.
We don't want to fail. We don't want to be embarrassed. And we don't want to feel like an idiot. Sometimes it helps to hear stories about other idiots so that we don't feel so alone. That's partly why I've learned to tell so many stories about my own failures and idiocy. It kind of diffuses them. So I have another story for you about an even bigger idiot, about someone who was so good at failure, he made a career of it. If you've ever felt foolish or inadequate because you made an idiot of yourself, this might make you feel better. It was a while ago. This is a history story. But he was a man without any apparent gifts or any apparent luck. Now, there aren't a lot of people like that, but there are some, and this looks like one. I've never personally known such a failure, and I doubt that you have either. First, he failed as a businessman. Maybe he thought politics would be easier, so the next year he ran for the state legislature, and of course he lost. He went back into business, and 2 years later he failed in business again. Besides his habit of failure, which he was going to perfect, life wasn't very kind to him, and he wasn't very lucky either. Because the following year his sweetheart died, and the next year, not surprisingly, he had a nervous breakdown. 2 years later, incredibly, he tried politics for a third time, and for a third time he lost. 2 years later, perhaps thinking that his problem was that he'd set his sights too low, he ran for Congress, and he lost. About this time in reading his story, I thought, this is a guy who doesn't get it. I mean, there are people like that, and this is one of them. Life was giving him all the clues he needed, and he wasn't listening. If he had any gifts, it seemed pretty clear by now that they didn't lie in running a business or in winning elections. How many times do you tip the boat over before you decide you weren't meant to be a sailor? Well, more than three. 3 years later, he ran for Congress again and was defeated again. And 2 years later, he tried again, and again he lost. This man had never won an election. He had run five times and lost five times. When do you get tired of bobbing up and down in the middle of the lake like fish bait? But he wasn't through. He decided again to aim still higher. So his sixth defeat was for the Senate. His seventh defeat was for the vice presidency. And his eighth consecutive defeat with no victories was for the Senate again. Finally, 2 years later, he was elected president. And then he won the second election of his life when he was reelected as president in 1864. If you look on your calendars or your daily planners, they'll tell you that tomorrow is his birthday. We Americans tell a lot of stories about Abraham Lincoln. But we almost never remember that in his entire life, he won only two elections and one war, and his victory in that war is still not universally acclaimed in some parts of the South. But my question is how, after so many successive defeats, was he able to keep choosing the feathered thing? How did he keep putting the boat in the water when it had turned over on him eight times in a row? I honestly don't know. I know that I would not have done it. I would have given up or found another career sometime before the eighth consecutive failure. I suspect most of you would have too. That's just one of the reasons that we won't have our birthdays written into the next century's calendars. He doesn't seem to have spent much time looking for sticks and bricks, looking to stop and make a home. But Abraham Lincoln had an amazing ability to keep looking for and finding hope over and over and over again. Now, if this were a competition, we could feel pretty inadequate next to Lincoln. But this isn't a competition. This is a church. And this is the time and the place where we gather together to seek inspiration from higher visions and strivings of more nobility and character. And everyone in history who came before us, who's part of the body of humanity, who succeeded greatly or failed greatly, every one of them is there to help us and to lend us their stories. Sometimes we do this by looking to the lives of great religious figures. Today, I use the life of a great American for whom official religion was really not a very important category. It's remarkable, I think, how many similarities we find in the lives of great religious figures and great civic figures. And one way of putting this similarity is to say that they all show the powerful presence of or awareness of an invisible kind of force, a kind of dynamism that helped them steer the course of their lives. It was not a supernatural force, although it seems to be greater than anything we can muster, but it's a kind of attitude. And the power of that hopeful, trusting attitude beckons to me through these stories, and I hope it beckons to you too. Because life wants to be an active word, not a passive one. And there is a source for that activity that seems to dwell within and around us. Call it the will of God, if you like. Call it the inner and outer movings of the Holy Spirit, the Tao, the dynamic presence of the life force. But it has feathers, this thing. And if we can keep seeking and choosing that feathered thing, it will absolutely make all the difference in the world.